Morning, everyone. Thank you so much for coming for this talk. How was the party yesterday? It was good? Has everyone recovered from the late party? So. I hope this talk helps you. If not, we can do some exercises in the meanwhile as well. So welcome to this talk. This talk is titled ASP.NET Identity. The code is DevB314. My name is Pranav Rastogi. I am a program manager on the ASP.NET team. My team owns these set of products around web development. So we have Visual Studio, MVC, WebForms, Signalr, EF, Identity, of course. And then we also have all of the work that happens as part of our global team, and using Azure SDKs. We have a lot of Azure integration on how do you publish these apps. We're doing a lot of work with the Azure Active Directory to sort of make it easier to create applications and authenticate with users coming from Active Directory and on-prem servers as well. So that's what my team does. For me in particular, I've been working with the team for the last, 7 years. This is a picture of me this year where I was out mountain climbing, and I was up on the mountain where I took a picture and then I uploaded it to Google. Google decided that since it was snow, it had to be snowing that time, so they selected this random GIF of a snowstorm, which they sort of uploaded in the picture itself. I was pretty amazed when I saw that because I was pretty sure I did not see any snow while I was there. Anyhow, so that's a little bit of tidbit which I like to share always. So I've been working with the ASP.NET team for the last 7 years. I started with ASP.NET Web Forms, moved to MVC, ASP.NET Core, SignalR. And for the last sort of 1.5, 2 years, I've been focusing on ASP.NET Identity, the membership story in ASP.NET. So I was involved when we did universal membership providers, SQL membership providers, simple membership providers. And that's what I've been working on for the last release of Visual Studio 2013 as well. There's a link to my blog as well, and there's a book that I've authored, so that's the link to that book as well. So in the theme of this talk for today is going to be around sort of what do you do with ASP.NET Identity. What is ASP.NET Identity? How do I do some of the basic features of logging in, registering a user, which I was doing before as well. But I think some of the key game changers that have been introduced in ASP.NET Identity are very interesting to discuss, and specifically scenarios around how do I do two-factor authentication in my application? How do I do social logins in my application so users can log in with different providers? And how do I manage these identities in my application as well? So we'll be talking to you about some of these new features that have come in Identity. And then we can also talk about how do I create applications and authenticate with Active Directory. So just a show of hands, how many people have used ASP.NET Identity right now? And are you guys on version 2.0 or 1.0? 1.0. Cool. So this is a 300-level talk. Then if you guys are comfortable, then I can start showing you a little more advanced features of Identity as well, based on how we feel about, the progress that we make. Are folks interested in seeing applications, creating applications and authenticating users with Active Directory? Okay. So there seems to be about 30-40% interest in that. So we'll touch upon that area as well. I have very few slides, so I'm going to be spending most of my time in demos, but this is the official slide deck, so I'll go through a few slides fairly quickly, and then I'll switch to demos, and then we'll talk about demos all up. So this is a little bit of history on the membership world. We started with the ASP.NET sort of 1.1, where we just had the forms authentication system. We didn't have a membership story. And then we came along with the ASP.NET SQL membership providers in ASP.NET 2.0, And the whole goal was to make it easier to add registration and login for users. So it came with a suite of login controls. It came with the Forms Auth module. It came with an experience that allowed you to create users on a SQL Server backend, because that was the prevalent technology back in time. Like, this is about 10 to 12 years before our time. So this worked great. In ASP.NET 4, so we came up with a simple membership. And simple membership was used in building web pages applications. And the goal behind simple membership was to make it easier to customize profile data for a particular user, because that was the scenario that we're trying to optimize it for. The underlying infrastructure for SQL membership simple membership providers was still membership. So it was still based on the extended membership model. It still was relying on Forms Auth module to the actual authentication and the cookie generation. It was still tied to SQL Server as the backend implementation that you wanted to have. And so it had all the infrastructure that SQL membership had. So then we came up with universal membership providers. And the reason we came up with universal providers was, you know, this is when SQL Azure was getting prominent, and we wanted to have a membership story where you can persist your membership information in all SQL providers. So it doesn't have to be SQL Server. You can target like SQL Server, SQL Azure, SQL CE, LocalDB. And so that was a scenario that was targeted with universal membership providers. It was, again, built on the same membership infrastructure and was still using Forms Auth module. It had the exact same infrastructure as before. And parallel during this time frame as well, we had the WIF Foundation come up as well, which allowed you to have like WS Fed protocol implemented in your application so you can authenticate users with that stack. And we had sort of a divergence in terms of these two stacks. So for example, when a user got authenticated, did you get a claim for a particular user or not, or how was the principle being set? So we kind of sort of diverge a little bit. But in starting 4.5, we sort of converged back, and then, you know, we have a same single principle that's used to sign in the user for both the WIF Foundation, the WIF libraries, and ASP.NET Identity as well. And then going forward, we have also started embracing claims for a particular user. So when you log in, you get a set of default claims for a particular user. And so, for example, if a user belongs to a certain roles are basically claims for a particular user. And you can add more claims for the user. You can remove claims for the user. So we started introducing those concepts in ASP.NET Identity, which helps us move to a common place. So no matter how you log in, you always get a well-known set of claims for a particular user itself. And so with Identity, what we wanted to focus was we wanted to have this one story for membership. It doesn't matter what kinds of apps you are building, whether it's web apps or web APIs. You can use Identity everywhere. If you are using, you know, web APIs and you have different clients connecting to those web APIs, those web APIs can be backed up by ASP.NET Identity for the membership system. There's a variety of providers that we plug in. So we plug in the Owen middlewares for Cookie Auth, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, and there's a contrib project where community members have contributed other providers like Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, GitHub, and there are quite a few of them out there. We still want to preserve the scenario of customizing profile. And so this goes back to the old SQL membership days where profile was serialized as binary data into your tables. And as an application developer, it was very hard to use profile. And so what we're doing now is we are embracing code first. We are embracing code first as a paradigm for modeling your applications and modeling your database. And starting code first, then you can just put profile as part of your user object itself. So it's like plain old C# classes and using CLR types for your profile data. Control over persistence is customizing the storage layer for membership. So by default, we have the core interfaces of Identity, and then we have an Entity Framework implementation that uses EF and stores the information in a SQL Server backend. But you can replace this EF implementation with anything that you want. And right now, we have about 13 to 15 community projects which range from anywhere to Azure Table Storage to DocumentDB, RavenDB, MongoDB. There's Azure. What was the last database that got released? Man, there's so many services coming up in Azure that it's like very hard to keep track of things. But so we have about 13 providers for identity, and that's control over persistence is all about that. You can now unit test your application code, so that means you can unit test your login actions, your register actions, because you can mock the identity framework, which is a huge improvement from before. It's all claims-based. We still have roles. Roles are stored in a separate table in the database, but that's just an implementation detail. They are just the claims for a particular user. The stack is fully async. Its minimum dependency is 4.5. So as long as your app targets 4.5, you can use this framework. So that's the minimum requirement. And then, you know, this is all good. This is the first question that I got asked when we released V1 is, how do I migrate? And this is one of the things I am a little proud of as well, is because in my personal experience, like as we have gone through these membership system, I don't think we've done a great job of putting such information out or putting such guidance documents out. So this is a slide which talks about how you can migrate your apps that were written in any of the previous legacy membership systems from SQL membership, simple membership, universal providers, and you can bring them forward to identity should you choose to. And you can bring them forward in the following two ways. You can bring them forward by either preserving your existing schema. So you have your schema that you've customized, and you can plug in the schema as it is to identity. Or you can choose to migrate your schema to the identity schema as well, if you choose to. I mean, the benefits of moving to the identity schema are that further upgrades are going to be seamless. If you choose to preserve your own schema, then for each new release of identity, you'll have to make some changes as well. But you have both the options. You also have the option of plugging in your own password hashers. So in all these years, if your system has a custom password hasher that you were using, you can reuse that hasher in the new identity framework as well. So you can replace the default hasher. And that's important if you want to preserve the behavior where users of your application do not have to change their passwords as you move schemas or as you change frameworks, basically. So that's another key point that I wanted to point out over here. And so the last bullet basically says that, you know, as long as your app can target 4.5, you can use identity. So, and this is the reason I'm saying that is because I got lots of questions where, so we shipped identity as part of the default templates in VS 2013. So it comes with MVC, Web API, SPA, Web Forms. But then I got a lot of questions from people who are using MVC 4 apps, and they wanted to upgrade to identity. So as long as your MVC 4 app or your Web Forms app targets 4.5, you can use identity in your application. For authentication, you know, these are the following strategies that we can have. and this was the key differentiator as compared to the old membership system, where the concept of social providers was not baked in. We only had a concept of a local user, and that's it. It was very hard to plug in external providers into the membership system. So now, fundamentally, we have a way of saying that a user can log in with a username and password, or a user can log in with any of the social providers or external providers like Active Directory and anything. So as long as you can, you know, log in, we can have an entry in the membership system as well. The next couple of slides are just going to be talking about the sort of a brute list of features. Like, we'll probably see most of these features in our demos for the next 1 hour, but you know, I just wanted to quickly go through these feature lists. You know, you can log in with username and passwords. You have external providers that you can use. You have a concept of roles. You can extend roles to implement groups if you want to, so that's an extensibility point. There's a concept of profile, so you can easily customize profile data. There are claims. You have the entire user management, so you can create users, delete users, you can query all the users, and you can do role management, so create, edit, manage roles as well. You can also do claims management of the user itself. So the fundamental pivot is, like, you know, you own the user object, and you can perform any operation on the user object. So that's the key message in that. The storage extensibility is customizing the persistence layer and changing it from SQL Server to be anything that you want. We are also enforcing stronger passwords, and that's a change that we started making in Tuo. It was not there in VannaWare. We got feedback from a lot of folks on some basic recommendations of what could be stronger passwords. Obviously, this is not the best password checker that you can have. There are many more that you can plug in. But that's an improvement that we have from before, where you can customize some of the settings of the password hasher. Two-factor auth is big. I think with the recent breaches of all accounts possible, and then as I think what we are observing is two-factor auth is becoming a mandatory policy for a lot of our products as well. So our source code for ASP.NET is open source on GitHub, but employees cannot join that GitHub organization until they have two-factor auth enabled. So two-factor auth is becoming a requirement, a standard for lots of organizations. Account confirmation, account lockout. You can use account lockout to protect against brute force attacks or logins. Single sign-out everywhere that uses a security stamp feature. So that means anytime you change your password or any sensitive information about your account, the security stamp gets rolled over, and it invalidates any cookie for you. So any place that you have logged in from, you'll be locked out. So this is useful if somebody hacks your account, and admins can roll your stamps forward, and you know, you'll be logged out of all sites over there. There's a change password, reset password, pluggable password hasher, custom password policies. These are examples where, let's say, if you change your password, you can have policies around. You can't reuse the last five passwords or last five patterns that you've had, or you need to change your password every 30 days or something like that. So you can plug in custom password policies. Validators and extensibility is around how do you validate a username, what's a valid email, what's a valid password. We have some inbuilt validators that you can override in your application as well. And the last one is sort of customizing the primary key, which is a very passionate topic in the world. And this is the whole world of, you know, in a relational database, what should be the type of my primary key? Is it GUID? Is it string? Is it int? Like, how do I get the most performant, like, primary key set? And there is never a good answer for it. We picked strings in V1, and so a lot of people had questions on how to change that. And in Tuo, we added this extensibility hook where you can customize the primary key of your membership database. And so you can customize it to be whatever suits your application needs. So I think that's big learning. This is the roadmap that we had. We had Vano, which got shipped with 2013 RTM. Tuo got shipped with 2013 Update 2, which has most of the features of account two-factor auth. 2.1 got shipped with 2013 Update 3, which added helpers for two-factor auth. 2.2 Alpha 1 is something we just released about a week back. It has bug fixes and performance improvements in this release. And then we're also looking at Identity 3.0, which is going to be part of ASP.NET vNext and Visual Studio vNext. The key message with Identity V3 is going to be all concepts are going to be the same, but it's going to retarget a new platform. So if some of you went for Scott Hunter's talk right before my talk, the talk is titled The Future of .NET on the Server. I'll encourage you to sort of see this talk later on, watch it online, and it'll help you set the context of what does ASP.NET vNext mean. So let's now just jump into demos. I have my phone turned on, so please do excuse me for any sound that comes, because I'm going to use it for my two-factor auth demos over here. And if you have any questions, you can raise your hand, ask them, and I'll answer it. They do have a mic at the back if you want to take a little walk. If you don't, then just shout out, and I'll repeat the question for everyone. And I'll try to go a little slow. Like, if folks are not able to understand me, then please do raise your hand. I'll try to accommodate as much as possible. Thank you. So what I have on my machine is I have Visual Studio 2013 Update 4 RC, and I'm going to be using Identity 2.1 in all of my demos. And I have a link to all these demos in the in the deck as well. So when I create an MVC or a Web Forms application, we had made this change in one ASP.NET for VS 2013, where you can choose what kind of authentication you want for your application. You can choose no auth, which means you have no auth. You have individual user accounts, which means you can create users in your application, or users can log in from external providers like Facebook, Google, and so on. You have organizational accounts, which means you can create applications that can target the following three identities. These apps can either target users from Windows Azure Active Directory, or you can build SaaS applications so that users from multiple Active Directories can log in, or you can create applications so that users from your on-prem ADFS servers can log in. So those are the three experiences that we have. I'll come back to the Active Directory, Azure Active Directory example in the end if folks are interested, but I'll start off with the individual user account scenario. So this will create an app for me where I'll be able to register a local user, I'll be able to log in, I'll be able to change his profile, and then I can enable two-factor auth, do a count lockout, count confirmation in this application. So I'll start showing you this entire flow, and I'll start pointing you out some of the details. All right. So let me run this application, and then let's see what we can do with it. I'm going to silence. All right. So I can quickly sort of register a user. So in the templates that we have, we are using email as the username. And in your applications, you can change this behavior to have username and email as two separate fields. General guidance that we have is whenever the framework does any queries in the database, it does by IDs. And user IDs is the one that we care about. And from a UI perspective, you can choose how do you want to customize the UI. So we chose that in the templates we are showing you where username and email are the same fields. So the password I'm entering is a little stronger password. Like earlier I could have entered 123456, but now I'm saying like one digit, one alphanumeric. So once I register a user, then I can come to the database. And I'll just show you what the schema looks like. So we have the following tables. So we have users, which contains the list of users over here. Then we have roles, which are the roles, and users in roles, and the logins. So logins tables stores basically, if you have a user, how many ways can a user log in? So by username, password, or Facebook, Google, Microsoft accounts, all the providers show up in this table as well. And then we have claims on what are the claims for a particular user. So the users table has all this information. So by default, we have the entire schema for Tuo. So for example, here's my email. And if you notice that email confirmed is false over here because I have not turned on email confirmation. And my username and my email are the same values because I chose username and email to be the same. And I have different fields for password hash. This is my security stamp, which gets changed each time I change my password, or I do change my login, or add or remove a login. And then different fields for two-factor auth, account lockout, and stuff. So this is the schema. I have this model called identity models file in my project. And I have this class called application user, which derives from identity user, and which is where I get my default schema. So if I want to start adding profile data, so I can just come into the user object, and I can add a field saying, birth date. And so what I'm doing right now is I'm just adding profile properties for a particular user. Now, since I've changed the schema of my database, I need to update the schema of the database to match the new birthday that I've added. So to do that, I can now drop down to PowerShell, where I can use Entity Framework CodeFirst migrations. CodeFirst migrations are a way where you can update the schema of your application based on the changes that you do to your model. So it's a Entity Framework 6 feature. So I can do enable migrations. And so this PowerShell command is going to build my project, and it's going to create an initial script for the existing schema of my application. So that means it'll have a list of users, roles, all the tables that I have. And it generates this initial script file over here. I can now do add migration and give it a name. And so this will add a script for changing the schema of my database to add this birth date field. And so if you look at this file, which will get generated right now, it has two commands, up and down. What up means is when you are changing the schema from a lower version of the database to a higher version, then add the birth date column. If you are going from an upper version of the schema to the lower version, then drop the birth date column. So that's what the schema does. And I can say update database. And so this is going to take these migration files that were generated, run it against the database, and update the schema as well. So if I now go back to Server Explorer, I refresh. So I should see the birth date column. So that's from a database perspective. Now, from an application perspective, I can use this birth date very easily as well. So I can drop down to my register view, and I'm going to add a birth date field over there. I'm going to show birth date. Did I set it as string or string? Okay. So I can set it to birth date, build it, go to my register view. And then add a field for it. Mm-hmm. And then I'm gonna drop down to my accounts controller in my register action. I can pass in birth date over here. So birth date equals model.birth date. So now if I build my application, log off. So now if I go and basically register a user, then I'll see the birth date column show up. Whatever. Go back. Server Explorer. Submit users. Show table data. So now both data show up. And it shows up as a string as well, so it's not serialized into binary data. So that's the advantage of using basing off on a code-first pattern, where your profile property is now serialized as, you know, strings or whatever types you specify. So the other piece of information I wanted to highlight over here was when we say we are using username and email as the same fields, all we are doing is when we create the application user, we just set the same value to both email and username. And so if you want to change it, you just have to change it over here, and then everything else stays the same. So that's a quick tidbit of information. So let's enable account registration, and let's make sure that an unconfirmed account is a user which does not have a confirmed email is not able to log into the system. So in the register action, instead of when I create the user, I was just signing them in. Instead of directly signing them in, I am going to send them a confirmation email. Right. I somehow changed the casing of these files. Right. Okay. So what's happening in these three lines is, so I create the user, then the user manager sends this, generates the email confirmation token, and we use DP API underneath the covers to hash the token. And I think by default the tokens are valid for a day, and you can customize how long the token should be valid. And then we have this send email async API, which actually sends the email. And in this template, we have this file called identityconfig.cs, where we have two services registered. We have the email service, which sends the email, and then we have the SMS service, which sends the SMS. And so whenever the user manager API sends email, it eventually calls into the email service and just sends the email. It's up to you to implement how you want to configure your email and SMS service. So I'm going to just delete the default stubs, and I'm going to add this snippet for SMS and email. In my example, what I'm doing is I'm using two services. I'm using SendGrid service to send email, and I'm using Twilio to send the text messages. Both have free subscriptions for a limited amount of time, for a limited amount of messages that you can use to try out. You can also use your own SMTP server if you want to. So I'm just going to install two packages into my project. And then I'm going to install Twilio after this. Right. So go back to identity config. Build it. And the last thing I want to do is, in the login action, I want to make sure that users who have unconfirmed emails do not log in. And this is a key scenario that I wanted to highlight, is which a lot of people were asking questions around as well. The framework does not take care of making sure that when you log in, does the user have confirmed email or not. It's the application's responsibility to make sure that when you're logging in, you can check whether the user has a confirmed email or not. And the reason it's made that way is because email confirmation can mean different things for different apps. So for example, some sites want to have the behavior when a user registers, they want to send an email confirmation, and until the user confirms, they don't want the user to log in. But some sites allow you to log in, but you cannot do any sensitive operation on the site. So you cannot like write data, or if you're a bank transaction, you can't send the transaction until you confirm your email account. Or if you're Amazon, you can't buy the product until you sign in with a confirmed email, but they let you browse. So you can customize this behavior as per your app requirements. So in this case, let's say if I want to block access to unconfirmed emails, then in my login action, I can basically check if the user is confirmed, has a confirmed email or not. And if it's not, then I can redirect them error page or tell them, like, you know, you need to confirm your email again. So this is the code that you have to add to make sure that users have a confirmed email. And you can reuse this code anywhere in your application to make sure that before you do any sensitive information, user has a confirmed email. So I can... let's launch this application. So I'll register with a real email right now. Password. And I can open up Outlook. So let's refresh. Yep. So I get this email over here. And I can confirm my account by clicking this link. And so when I click this link in my database, the email confirmed flag was set to true. So now I can click here to log in. And now I'm logged into this site. So you can customize this email message as well. So what the message gives you is, you know, what's basically my my destination, what's my text, what's my body, and then you can put in both text and HTML formats. You can customize how your email should look like based on your application needs, and you would do it over here if you had to. Let's turn on two-factor auth for this application, so this particular user can use two-factor auth. I can go into my manage views. And I'm going to uncomment this line. And so this is basically going to add a phone number. And I'm going to enable the option of two-factor as well. And I'll explain you what this means. So build my application. I'll show you the flow, and I'll point you out to the pieces of code that are interesting. Right. So now if I click this link, it's going to go to manage, and you will see that I have these operations I can do in my account. So I can add a phone number. I can enable two-factor auth. So let me add a phone number. I have hard-coded the backend to be my phone. So I should get a text, and the text should come through the Twilio service that we registered. Just came through. Let's look it up. 61515. And so the reason we have this experience where if you want to change any sensitive information for a user, so be it email or phone number, you should verify that information before you preserve it in the database. So that's why when I enter a phone number, I get this option of requirement of adding the code over there itself. I can now optionally turn on two-factor auth for my account. And if I log off, log in, so now my login action has redirected me to a page for two-factor auth. And the reason that happened was because in my accounts controller, now if I go and check out the login action, so we have on line 90 this code, which is what we introduced in 2.1, where password sign-in now takes in the username password. And again, you can change this to be what your username is going to be. And it can return the following three status, like either it was successful, or it was logged out, or the account requires verification. And the reason we know that we entered this state was because in the UI, when I said enable two-factor auth, it sets a flag in my database that two-factor auth is enabled for this particular account, so don't log him in. And so I'm redirected to the send code UI. And send code UI shows me the following two providers and how I can get my code. And the way this list of providers works is it's the list of confirmed information about you. So by default, we've confirmed email. We've confirmed an SMS provider for you. So we show you these two dropdowns. And you can plug in more factors. So if you confirm and add an authenticator app, we'll show you the authenticator app in this example. So I can choose a phone code, and I can submit, and I should get a text. And I can log in. So this was my two-factor flow in my application. I'm going to show you how account lockout works. And the behavior of account lockout has changed from the earlier membership systems. In the earlier membership systems, when account lockout was enabled, your account was locked out, and it required an admin action for them to go and unlock your account. In this system, what we realize is like that is not a very friendly experience where it leads to more pain than being useful. So what we've done is how account lockout is going to work is if anybody tries to hack your account or your codes or your passwords for X times, we are going to lock your account for 5 minutes, configurable, and it's a sliding expiration. So after 5 minutes, you can go and log back in. And if somebody tries to hack your account again, then it's going to lock you out for 5 minutes again. So that's how account lockout is going to work. And you can configure account lockout in identity config. We have application user manager, which derives from user manager. And the reason we have put an application user manager in the application itself is because you can customize the app specific behaviors in your application as well. So for example, when we create the user manager, you can configure the account lockout settings, and you have three settings. You can enable account lockout for users. So for example, you can enable account lockout or disable account lockout for certain users if you choose to. You can configure the default account lockout time span. Like we've picked 5, but for this demo, I'm going to pick just 1. And you can configure the max failed attempts before the account gets locked out. And so in this case, it's going to be 2. And then in the actual sample, you can use account lockout in different places. So you can use account lockout to protect against people guessing passwords or people guessing codes for your two-factor auth. And so you can protect against both these places. So in the login action, the sample that we have doesn't trigger account lockout because I think we feel that for most cases, people are going to have stronger passwords and account lockout is not so interesting in the login case. But if I go to the account lockout case where I'm sending code, so let me go to the send code action. Actually, it's verify code. Right. So when we are verifying your code, while we are verifying it, if we get a status of account lockout, we lock your account, and then it'll be locked out for like a default time span. So I can build this application, go back to the sample, log in again. I'll get the code. I hope I typed in the correct password. Right. So I get a phone code. So in this case, now if I start typing incorrect codes, so my account is not locked out. So it's locked out for 1 minute. So I won't be able to log into my account for a minute. And after that, I can sort of retry as well. So that's how account lockout is going to work as well in identity. All right. Let's see how social logins are going to work. And I'm going to switch to a different application for this demo. Right. So other change that has happened as we've moved to Identity 2 from membership is we have moved away from a config-based configuration to a code-based configuration. So all your settings around what's my cookie expiration, what's my default login path, has moved from being in System Web Config to being in Owen middlewares in startupauth.cs. And then the other shift that we have done is we have moved away from Forms Auth module to Owen cookie middleware. So that means if I go into this template in web.config, we explicitly disable the Forms Auth module itself as well, because we want the Owen cookie middleware to work and generate cookies, and sliding expiration and anything that happens around it happens with Owen cookies itself. So in your application, you will see this class called startup, which has the following. Let me make sure this VS is closed. I'll come back to it later. Okay. Right. And I'm pointing you out, like, since most of you folks have been using 2.0, so I'm pointing out some of the key areas to look at and sort of understand and make sure that we have the best practice. So we have per Owen context registration for DB context and user manager. And what per Owen context does, it's an example of a poor man's DI, where we put the instance of user manager and DB context in the Owen pipeline, and so that we can retrieve the user manager in the accounts controller. You can replace this and use your own DI system if you want to use Ninject or Autofac or anything else. If you're using your own DI system, then you don't have to use the per Owen context way of registering user managers. So that's just some information. So this is how my cookie information, cookie registration looks like. So I'm saying my authentication type is application cookie. Login path is the following. And then we have a cookie authentication provider where I am specifying a security stamp validator. And this is what gets used for single sign-out or rolling the security stamp forward. So anytime I change a password, it's the security stamp validator that does the check. And I'll show you more on how it works. And then I have my external sign-in cookie. So external sign-in cookie is used in a flow where once you log in from Facebook and the request comes back to your application, the data that gets transferred is transferred in a cookie, and this is a temporary cookie that lives in your application for about, I think, about 5 minutes, which you can configure. And once you log into the application, this cookie goes away. And then I have the following social providers in my sample, which, like the way the app is set up is, I can start uncommenting any of these providers. Let's say I have Microsoft. And then when I launch this application, I also have Facebook. So if I just launch this application right now, I'll have an option of logging in with either Facebook or by Microsoft account. Let me make sure this Visual Studio instance is closed. Oops, sorry. Went away. Let's see if we can change that. Right. Okay. So now when I log in, you would see now I have an option of Facebook and Microsoft. And the way this is set up is like if you start bringing in more providers, so you bring in the GitHub provider or you bring in any other provider, you can just register it in startup, and then your app is going to start lighting up more options for logging in. So we have kind of centralized this experience where you can quickly bring in more providers as well. So I'm going to show you the demo for this application, and then I'm going to explain you the different parts of it that are working in. So this demo is about I am going to go log in with Facebook, and usually when we log in with Facebook, by default we get maybe the username, maybe the email, and the ID, and that's it. And if you're building applications where you want to have more content that you want from Facebook, so you want more scopes, well, let's say in this application I'm saying, give me all my friends, give me all their pictures, is what I want to get from this application. So let's see how that works. I'm going to go Facebook info. So I'm putting a few strategic breakpoints so that we can see the flow of this application as well. Right. Let's debug. Try again. Right, so this is the first request. It's going to set up all the middlewares for me. So now I can go click login and then log in with the Facebook provider. So Facebook is an OAuth2-based flow. And a recent change that happened was we used to have Google, which used to have an OpenID endpoint. And Google deprecated the OpenID endpoint in about March. They said they'll deprecate, and by September they wanted to deprecate. And Google has moved from OpenID to OAuth to OpenID 2.0 as well. So if you guys have any existing clients, they will not work with OpenID for Google, so you need to switch to the OAuth implementation. And for Owen middlewares, we have switched from, if you're on Cortana 2.0, you need to switch to Cortana 3.0 to get the changes as well. So now I can log in using my Facebook account. And since the first time I'm logging in and I'm requesting all these scopes, which are not part of the default request, then I get this prompt saying, do I trust this application and is it okay to give access to all these scopes? So I trust my application, I wrote it. So request comes back. And so F10. So now it's a so user is null. So in this case, I don't have an account. So in social flows, you can have the following flows. When a user logs in from a provider, you can create a local account for the user, or where the user can specify a display email for themselves, or you can choose to skip this step and just use the one that you got from the external provider itself. So this, in our samples, we show you the step where users can choose what the local display name is going to be. So that's why they are prompted with this screen. And so in this case, I have logged in with my Facebook account. And now if I click Facebook info, so what's going to happen in this case is in my middleware registration, I was passing in the Facebook access token, which I got from Facebook, into my application. And in my application, I stored this Facebook access token as a claim for a particular user. And I can get this access token. And I'm using a library called Facebook C# SDK, which is a NuGet package, where you can pass in the access token. And it's you can make queries and get information from the Facebook endpoints as well. So in this case, I'm just making a call to the me endpoint, me/friends. And I'm getting the list of all friends over here. So let's just run to end. And then these are all the pictures of my friends that I'm pulling in. So you can sort of build more richer UIs once you start adding more scopes to the external social providers and then use the access token to get more information. You have to store the access token somewhere and you have to refresh the access token because these access tokens are maybe short-lived or long-lived. And at some point, they expire. So you have to handle the mechanism of how do you refresh these access tokens in your application as well. But so this was an example of how you can add social providers. And if I go to my Server Explorer and I look at my logins table, and in this user logins, if I say show table data, you will see now that I have this login provider Facebook for this user ID. So you can map different logins to users as well. The benefit of using social providers is users do not have a password. So in my if I do show table data, the password hash is going to be null because users are not creating a password on my site. They're creating a password on Facebook. So you don't have to maintain the users' passwords on your site itself. So that's the benefit. But the drawback is users have to have a social account. Like, so you have to pick and choose. I'm going to restart Visual Studio just so that we can make a little more progress because it's chewing up a lot of memory. Do you have any questions? Yes. Yes, so the question is, can I have side by accounts? So can a user have a password and a Facebook login as well? Yes, they can absolutely. So in the manage page, there's an option of create password, and you can always create a password and log in with that password as well in your application. Do folks want to go more deeper in the content, or is this level okay? Okay. So this is an example where I'm going to show you single sign out. So single sign out is an experience where if I am logged in from multiple machines on multiple clients, I can optionally choose to, when I sign out, either sign out from a single machine or sign out from all machines that I've logged in from. And this is an experience that we have if you're using Hotmail. You know, you can sign out from everywhere. And it's useful if you are browsing to sites from a public domain, like cafes and stuff. So I can register an account here. And I can open up in Chrome. So you would see in IE, now we are keeping track of all the clients for a particular user. So this username was foo. And so now I have two clients that I have for this where I've logged in from, IE and Chrome. And I have this sign out everywhere button. And if I click this button, it's going to sign out everywhere, which means basically what it does, it's going to roll over my security stamps. And if I go to IE and refresh, my cookie is no longer valid, so I get signed out from this particular browser as well. So that's how a single sign out works. The key areas which are important from a code perspective are the following. So in my startup, I still have my registration of my security stamp validator, but I am customizing this behavior. So if you notice, it's deriving from its application cookie validator. And what the application cookie validator does is, so let me backtrack a little. So what I have on the users, first of all, is in my users object, I have a collection of clients. So each time I sign in, I basically take the browser ID and I put it in the database. So I have a list of clients for the browser. Each time I sign out, what I do in my application cookie validator is I basically iterate over all the clients that I have, and I get the security stamp, and then I verify the client ID. And if the stamp is not valid for a particular ID, then I basically invalidate it, and I return false from it. And that's how the stamp gets rolled forward, and that's how the clients are sort of locked out itself. So this is a sample which is available publicly as well. You guys can look at it and try it out. This is how you can sign out for a particular application. Right. I'm going to show you an example of how you can add roles for a user and how you can protect different parts of the site. So I'm going to show you the UI first, and I'm going to show you the parts of the code. So this example is I have an admin section where I can see all the logs for a particular user. So what is the activity that the user is doing? And the user obviously does not have access to that log. When I launch the application, I have seeded the database with a default admin. So the default admin name is admin@example.com. And then the password is admin@123456. And let's go here and log in. Let's register. So if you notice on the left side, I have this admin link that shows up because this particular user is in the role admin. And when I register a new account in this in Chrome, you would see that now I'm saying like the user is signed in. And then in Chrome, I don't see the admin link. And then, so that's basically the demo. And the interesting code pieces is in my application, I'm using Entity Framework Code First, and I'm using a default initializer which will create the admin role for me. So in my application DB context, I'm setting this initializer. And inside my initializer, I am seeding the database with this username, and which is an admin user. And I use the identity APIs to create the role admin, you know, and add the user to the role admin, basically. So that's what it does. And then in my UI, in my layout, I basically am doing the same checks. User is in role admin. And in my admin controller, I just have authorized roles equal to admin. So it's the same authorized attributes that we're using. It's just that how do you create users and how to add users to a role is what changes in this application itself. So actually, like this. All right. Do you guys want to see more identity demos, or do you want to see a demo with Active Directory? 80? Okay. So let me create an app which does a single sign-on. And I'll refer it to you to a talk by Vittorio, which will go more in depth if you're interested. So in MVC app, I can now configure an app to run the following three ways, where an app can target a single sign-on, which means users can log in from one Active Directory. Users can target multiple orgs. So that's an example of an app like Yammer, where in Yammer you can log from like at Microsoft.com or at Dell.com Active Directories. And on-prem is you just have an on-prem ADFS server. So I can specify my domain, and you can create, I believe now you can create multiple Active Directories in the Microsoft Azure portal. And now I can specify what access level do I want for this particular app. So that means this app can have the following access in the Active Directory. Single sign-on means only signing in. Read means I can have read access to the user's data, so I can get user's information, for example, their department information, address, email. And read and write means I can update the user's information as well. So I can choose read for this example. And then I have to log in with credentials for my Active Directory. Right now, in the tool, you have to specify an administrator. But the Azure portal allows you to create applications as a normal user as well. And this restriction is going to go away eventually. And I can specify the password. And say OK. So what's going to happen behind the scenes is the VS tool will create an app in this Active Directory's tenant, and then register this app with this Active Directory and set the permissions that I selected in my applications. So this project is going to get created. The VS tooling will create this app in Active Directory. Right now, the project is using the WIF modules, but we have done the work in Katana Trio to have Owen middlewares for WSFed and OpenIDC Connect. And eventually, our templates will change to use the new Owen middlewares as well. So now if I launch my application, we've set up a blanket redirect for the entire app. So nobody can access this app until the user logs in. So the first time when I try to browse to this application, I'll be redirected to the login page from Active Directory, and where I have to sign in with my credentials. So in this case, I can sign in with any kinds of users. Like they can be normal users in role admin or not in role admin. And And then I can specify the password. And so now the user is logged in. This was the user. If I click the user, we see the profile data for our user. And the way we get profile data is we just make a call to the graph endpoints for getting the user's information. So these are the endpoints for talking to this particular Active Directory tenant. And here's how we get the user profile. So we get the list of claims. We iterate over them here and get the JSON response back. So that's how you can create applications with Active Directory, and you can target the flows of creating an Active Directory or with single sign-on or multiple organizations, or you can select on-premise as well. And if you have applications which are on-prem or using the Active Directory on-prem, you can sync your AD between the on-prem AD and the cloud AD as well. So there are tools that help you sync and then maintain applications as well around it. So I just wanted to pull up the resources deck. And I'll be at the Ask the Experts I'll be at the developer booth right after this talk. So all of our docs are on ASP.NET/-identity, like the tutorials on two-factor auth, count password, the links to the single sign-out samples. The recommended resources has all the links to blog posts and videos. The migration guides talk to you about how do you move to the identity framework from wherever you are. Two-factor auth, there's the Google Authenticator app example and walkthrough of plugging in an Authenticator app in identity. We used to have a web admin tool that we used to ship with VS. We have deprecated that tool, and we are looking for sort of community contributions in that area. One example that we have is web admin. We're using ThinkTecture Identity Manager, which was written by Brock Allen. It's still in preview, but it's a NuGet package that you can install in your application, which allows you to manage identities in your application. So you can create users, add users to roles, create roles, and manage them. There's the identity samples, which has samples on single sign-out, customizing the primary key, two-factor, how do I plug in existing membership systems, how do I plug in my own custom membership system, how do I plug in my own custom schemas into identity. There's a RavenDB sample by Tuckberg on how do you customize the identity providers. And then there's the list of all identity providers that we sort of accumulated that are written by community. So, you know, do take a snapshot of the slide or do download it, and please do check out these resources. So with that, like, we have 2 minutes left. If you have any questions, feel free to ask me. I'll be around here after the talk as well. You can come up and ask questions. Thank you so much for coming for my talk, and have a great rest of the conference.